Folks, you can support the hardest working sports talk show in South Florida through Cash App or Venmo. Just search Cash Big O Show. Support us through Cash App or Venmo. Cash Big O Show. We thank you for your incredible support.
Right. It is time to grind the tape with Kyle Crabb's Locked On Dolphins podcast. How you feeling, baby? You feeling good?
I'm good. I'm fired up for tomorrow night and hope everything's well with you. How's your foot doing?
Great, dude. I'm walking and I'm driving. I went to my first concert last night in months. So even one of my listeners offered me a pair of tickets for Journey and Toto, parking pass and all at the Hard Rock. And I was like, it was like my third week of surgery. And I'm like, you know, my wife was wheeling me around, Kyle. So I'm like, you know, I appreciate it. And I had to pass up on it. I would have taken it in a heartbeat. But you know what it is to get out of the car. And then my wife is like wheeling me all the way through the Hard Rock. I can't do that to the woman. I mean, it's just embarrassing. So I missed like three concerts that I really wanted to go to. And so I was glad last night. I had seats and everything. So it was funny. I had front row seats. And both singers told everybody to stand up. And I'm the only idiot staying sitting down there.
I'm like, you know, bro, it's baby steps, right? So
exactly.
Not going to rust off.
Yeah, I drove and I walked in and that's accomplishment for me, dude. So I'm going to stay sitting down rocking and enjoying the concert. And that's exactly what I did. You know, Kyle, one of the things I like doing on my show, I don't like doing the micro because the micro tends to make people panic about the moment, but you're not really looking at the big picture. And so that's what I like about, before we get into the draft, I want to get your thoughts on this because this is what I've been trying to tell Dolphin fans. You know, you went on a run these next 2 years, this year and next year, where you hit on a shitload of picks. And you got to decide what you want to do. You're never going to be able to sign all the picks when you hit on a two-year span like they did. So they decided we're signing Tua and the next wave of free agents. That's where we're going to manage everything. And then the next 2 years are the 2 years where they traded all the top-heavy picks for the Jalen Ramseys and the X's and all that other stuff. And so your picks are later picks, and you may not have to re-sign a lot of them. And really, outside of Achan, nobody's really looking for a big contract. So you're going to have more flexibility down the line. And so you have to look at it on a macro sense because this actually happens to every team in the league. You're going to have to make tough decisions. And the other thing I tell people is look at what Chris Greer does. Don't listen to him. He pays tackles. He pays receivers. He pays quarterbacks. He pays number one shutdown corners. You know, he pays pass rushers. That's what he pays. Look at the class that just left. It's not really a tackle. From what I know from inside the building, they really still don't consider Wilkins a pass rusher. So they weren't going to pay him pass rusher money. Next year, your pass rusher's up, your number one receiver's up. It gets ugly all of a sudden.
Yep.
You got to start paying these kind of people. So for me, I try to explain the macro instead of the micro because the micro has, it's a cap crisis. No, dude, this is part of the process. And if you look at the big picture, it's kind of set up for them over the next couple of years where, now they got to be kind of tight over the next 2 years to take care of in-house business. And then the next 2 years after that, they're going to have more flexibility. Your thoughts on all of that?
Yeah, I think looking at the micro is how you end up with the opinion of the first Monday of free agency was one of the darkest days in the history of the franchise, which is just like an offensively out of touch opinion to come away with when you lose Robert Hunt and Christian Wilkins to the tune of, what was it, $220 million or whatever it was for those two contracts that they signed, right? So, I think there's a perspective issue that I think a lot of followers of this team, it can be difficult to have because the past 15 years or so, there's not been a lot of continuity with what's happened. So you've always kind of been in the same two chapters of we're starting over and we're trying to build. And then we're starting over and we're trying to build. And now this brain trust, this organization, this iteration of the team has kind of moved into a third chapter where you do have to make difficult decisions while trying to maintain the identity of the team and who you want to be. And I agree with you wholeheartedly, making decisions to paying Christian Wilkins and paying Robert Hunt means you probably aren't paying Jaylen Waddle. And it means you're probably not paying Jalen Phillips. And as you said, there's very clear tendencies in what positions this brain trust and this football operation has an appetite to pay for in its premium position. So I agree with you wholeheartedly. I really appreciate you sharing that because that's been one of the central themes for me too, is it's like, look, this is the deal when you aren't hiring a new GM and a new head coach every other year for 15 years, which is what the Dolphins did for 15 years in the midst of the Patriots dynasty.
And here's the best part. I don't know if you agree with me on this. Okay, you lost Christian Wilkins. You got to kind of overcome that. Well, guess what? You in the first and second rounds, you might have that option of actually breeding a kid over the next couple of years that could end up replacing him. So you kind of have that transition. But the way I look at it, I think you got better at linebacker with Brooks.
You got deeper.
You got better at corner with Fuller. You know, so it's like the first, you mentioned it right off the get-go. The first they panic, I'm like, what is wrong with you people? Can you just wait till they do everything? Right. And it's been genius. The way they've revamped the team is what people don't understand, actually. And then, oh, no, this is a setback. This is a reset. No, dude, there's no time for Chris Greer and Mike McDaniel to reset. They don't have that luxury. They got to win, dude. They got to win and get out there. And they're doing it. And then I don't think people understand the way they're going about things. And that's the problem. And you panic. But now when you, again, instead of the micro on the first day, now we look at what's gone on over what's it been, nearly 60 days or something, yeah. 45 days. Now the picture on the macro end looks a hell of a lot better, correct?
Yeah, and I think that's going to be applicable for the draft too, where we're going to get whatever pick they make at 21, and it's going to be the best thing ever or it's going to be the worst thing ever. The draft is 7 rounds long, and you don't need to be ready on May 1st to play a football game, right? There's a whole other wave of free agency that happens. There's the other talent acquisition opportunities that are going to be there to be had. And I think this theme would be good perspective to carry into the draft too. Now, if they draft another corner, would I probably be a little annoyed? Yes, absolutely. You draft another corner high after Cam Smith and the redshirt year. Sure. There's things that they can do that would push my buttons. But at the same time, get the full picture of what the full draft class looks like in every decision that they make, and then try to see it for what it is. And then look out across the rest of the league and see what else is available for veterans in free agency. I'd love for them to get another safety, for example. But if they don't, and they've got this post-June 1st money that's rolling around, I still got Quandre Diggs out there in free agency. I still got Justin Simmons out there in free agency. There's going to be options there. And I think that's some of the rumblings that we're hearing about for how the first round is going to go tomorrow night is probably correlated a lot to what free agency didn't have. We're hearing a lot of tackles early, like a run on tackles. And I know for a lot of people, it's offensive line no matter what, you know. But if you get 7 tackles that go in the first 20 picks, are you drafting a guard at 21? No, and I think all the same storylines about how Chris Greer and this football operation pays players, it's been applicable when you look at the history of how they've used first-round draft picks.
Right.
I just don't know. Like, if the offensive line board doesn't break well, I would not advocate to just draft the next offensive lineman because that's how you get yourself in trouble, drafting for needs and taking lesser players.
Well, but I think that's the beauty. I've been talking about this at 21 for them. They can actually get a pass. If all those linemen are going, then that means Verse, Latu, somebody fell to them there at that point. So you can get your pass rusher. Mm-hmm. And then maybe if you need your guard, you can go in the second round. The other thing that I was thinking, I was talking with one of the guys yesterday, that Jackson Powers Johnson is one of those guys that I keep asking around that they still think he could drop past 21. So if
I think he's in the second round.
So there you go. So yeah. If you really like Jackson Powers Johnson, and this is what I'm thinking, you drop out of there down you pick up a third, right? All of a sudden, now you've got your safety pick, which is what you're talking about. Second or third round, you're either getting something, either a D tackle, that there's going to be a couple there in that second round area. I love the Rohu, whatever the hell his name is.
Clemson, yeah.
You like him, the kid from Clemson?
Yeah, he's really toolsy, and he got a late start in football, and I think you could tell as far as just the polish isn't quite there yet.
Oh,
Austin Clark's one of the most well-regarded assistant coaches on this coaching staff for some of the work that he's done. Think about the work that he did with Zach Sealer. Think about the work that he did, you know, first-round pedigree guy in Christian Wilkins. But nevertheless, the growth that those kind of guys showed, a guy like Rook, I think would be a really exciting potential day to add to that group for the tools. And the beauty of what they've done with all the defensive tackles they've added is I think they're going to be a very high-volume rotation group in 2024. I think there was only one player on the Baltimore Ravens defensive interior defensive line last year that played more than 50% of the snaps. So you're going to have bodies that rotate through. And for a guy who needs to get his footing under him and continue to develop as a player, I think Orohoro is a great example of a player from Clemson who would make some sense as a day two developmental type. But I think you need more picks in that range if you're going to go that route.
Yeah. Yeah. And so many things can go like what you're saying. Like if a run on tackles go and then you're like, okay, well then, all right, we love Jackson Powers. So let's trade back. If we can find a partner, pick up ourselves an extra third rounder, we'll get Jackson Power. And then what we could do with the rookie is we can play Jackson at guard, have the veteran Aaron teach him the calls, everything, all of that. Plus they're both agile. Mm-hmm. And as you know, in this system, now you can start pulling these cats all over the place, which is going to be absolutely fantastic for you at the same time. So you can do that, and then later on you can move him into center if you want down the line, since you have Aaron signed for a couple of years. And at the same time, you also have serious depth at that position for Tua. So if something happens to Aaron, you know, Powers can kind of step in. So you can end up moving back if that run on tackles happens. If you're not, if maybe Latu's injury history you don't want to take a chance on, and versus God. Okay, so let's move back a little bit. Let's get him. Let's get our an extra pick down the line. And now we could try to fill out the D-line and maybe the safety, you know, at that point. Because in the second and third rounds, you probably can think of a couple of safeties.
Yeah, so I think from an interior offensive line front, it sounds like Graham Barton, who's been a popular selection in mock drafts, it sounds like he's going to go before Miami gets on the board. So I don't think they're going to get a crack at him. I was talking to an NFC team source yesterday, and they said they think his clock starts in the early teens. And that's a testament of this offensive line run that's expected to happen, where you thought maybe, oh, the Titans get Joe Alt at 7. That's the first tackle. Maybe tackle 2 comes off in the early teens. That sounds like you might get 3 tackles in the top 10. And then that's kind of putting a guy like Barton, who I see some parallels for tackle capability, but he could play center, but he could also play guard. You look at Peter Skoronski from Northwestern last year. He went, I think, 11 to the Titans as a guy who ended up playing inside at guard this year. So that's kind of the same range that I was given for expectation for him. I think Jackson Powers is a better guard than he is a center, just because he doesn't have the reps and volume. So I think that works out well to complement Brewer. I think what's interesting is I've heard I talked to somebody else yesterday, and they told me their team had him as a guard exclusive player. Like they weren't even interested in playing a guard. So that feeds further into, from a position of value standpoint, a guy that's probably going to not go in the top 32 picks. Now, I think Dallas kind of lingers there at 24. They need desperately a center. They lost Beatus in free agency. Maybe they take him because they feel he's a good scheme fit. But I think all of this assumption about Jackson Powers Johnson being top 24 pick, I think it's out the window. I think he's got a pretty good chance of getting back into kind of the middle of the second round, maybe, just based off of if teams kind of universally say, hey, last year was his first year at center. The snaps weren't really good. I don't hear a lot of people talk about that, but there was Dolphins fans had issues with Connor Williams' snap issues.
Yes.
Go look with a fine tooth brush at some of the snaps that Oregon had last year, because he's rolling them back like a bocce ball. He's putting them behind the guard where Bo Nix got to reach across the guard's butt to try and get one in the shotgun snap in their own 2-yard line. Like, that stuff exists on his tape. So I think that's a great opportunity if he does get into the middle of the second round. that can be a kind of player that I like Brewer a lot in this system at center. I don't like him at guard because he is a smaller player. He doesn't quite have the anchor. I thought his pass rush issues and pass protection were amplified in 2022 when he played at guard versus playing at center. So I feel like that's kind of a good chemistry blend. And if you get into an emergency break glass situation, he can play center. I just think he'd be better at guard.
And then the other thing that works out for them, again, the way they've designed all this shit, is that if the run on tackles, there's a good chance that you probably won't have a left tackle that you really want there at that spot at 21. There's a good chance you'll have a right tackle, a guy that can play guard or right tackle. Well, the beauty of the Dolphins, again, I'm thinking macro. This is what I try to bring to people on our damn show, is that I'm of the believing that Austin Jackson's athleticism, his confidence is soaring, and that in another year, he would be ready to move over to left. And so the youngin can come in and play guard this year and then be moved over to right tackle. And when Teron moves on, you can move Austin to left. You know, I still have hope for Keon, because I got excited for Keon.
He flashed big time last year.
Yeah, dude. And I told everybody he would make the team, and he made the team. And who knows? They may have a starter there that's brewing that we don't even know yet. But, you know, that's – so for me, in the macro picture, again, to kind of keep harping on that, I think Austin Jackson's a guy that has the ability finally to play left tackle now, because he has the foundation around him, the people that can teach him. And you always kind of looked at him that way, and his athleticism is supreme. So I just kind of think that they could be paying him the right tackle money for the next couple of years playing left tackle, which is a Chris Greer special, by the way.
Right. And you know, you get into the macro and decisions and good economic outcomes for you. I mean, that's the Zach Sealer contract too, right? On the other side of the ball. You tried to negotiate with Christian Wilkins all summer long. You get the roster cutdowns. Christian don't want to sign. Okay, we'll sign Zach for half the money, and he's going to give us more sack production and more pass rush productivity than Christian did anyway. So right. I think that's a great point as far as capitalizing on some of the positional versatility that Austin came in with from USC, being a left tackle, playing there early, playing at guard, playing at right tackle, settling in there, signing a right tackle contract in kind of the make or break year. Now they've got a ton of flexibility, and I think the floor does exist of that's an adequate level starter at worst. And I think he's still got a lot of room to get better.
Exactly. That's my thing. And now you have the right people teaching you.
Yeah.
To me, that's the key for Austin since he got here. He didn't have foundationally a great offensive line coach and offensive scheme and coordinator and all that. That's so important to all these guys. Look at what's going on now. They get the most out of anybody that lines up, you know, pretty much. So I just kind of think like so many people think about cap crisis, and it's like, no, dude, they're actually doing a lot of smart things that will end up down the line also managing the cap and saving you some money down the line. And I think potentially at 21, you're kind of set up that you could fill multiple needs without really going crazy. Or if somebody wants to move up, you might have the flexibility of actually picking up something extra and still getting a player in the mid 20s if you wanted to move down, or late 20s.
Yeah. You know? So I think their strategy at 21, I think if there's a player that's too good to be true, they probably stick and pick. They don't get cute there, which I would advocate. If one of the top three edge guys is there, if there is an offensive tackle that you have graded highly who can play guard in a short term, whether that's, I think the two F's from the Pac-12, Fatanu from Washington or Fuaga from Oregon State. I think if either one of those guys or the edge guys are there, there's an intersection of position of need with really good value on the board with a premium position, I'd stick and pick. If you don't get that break and say Latu's there, it sounds like Latu's going to be off the board. So there's some momentum of him being a top half of the first round guy. But if he's there for the medicals, and the medicals scare you a little bit. I know Johnny Newton, the defensive tackle from Illinois, has a Jones fracture in his foot. There's a high re-injury rate with that. So it sounds like some teams have backed up off of that. But the tape's first round tape for sure. If those kinds of things do scare you and you don't get that home run player, I'd love to see him go either way, right? You could drop back a few spots, pick up a 4, and then you have the flexibility to use a 4 and a 3 next year, knowing you're getting comp picks. to come up into the third if you want to this year, or you can go big back and you can hopefully cash in on where the real meat, I think, of this draft class is, which I think there's about 20 players that you feel really good about. Miami should have a crack at one because of the quarterbacks that go early, but top 75, top 100, it's a really good class in that regard, and Miami's kind of lean there. So I think they'll have options. I wouldn't be mad either way. But I think that the words you've kept alluding to when both talking about the draft specifically and then from a macro perspective of how the team runs is flexibility. How many times do you get into since 2019, 2020 with this version of the Dolphins, and they talk about what they want to be, and we want to be flexible. We want to be able to make adjustments on the fly. We want to have the ability to make decisions, to be aggressive when we need to be aggressive or when it's appropriate to be aggressive, or be conservative and transition and pivot. And this is just the latest step in that. And I think they've put themselves with who they've signed in free agency to be aggressive if they want to be aggressive, be conservative if they want to be conservative, and not be boxed into a corner because they only want to draft one guy because they have to get a starter in this particular spot.
All right, so if I asked you what's the realistic, because that's what when I talk to you, at least we're talking realistic. I talk to fans, and I want Brock Bowers at 21. That's not going to happen, bro. Slip a crack pipe in front of him instead of a bong mask, and maybe we could get him at 21. But so who's the realistic ideal pick for Kyle Crabbs for the Miami Dolphins at 21?
I think the best player that I would have ranked for the Dolphins that I think has a better than coin toss chance of being there at 21 is Jared Verse, the edge from Florida State. I think he's a three down defender early. He's got outstanding power ability. It sounds like Latu has at least two fans in the top 16 that I think he's potentially edge one. I think the offensive line run pushes the edge guys down in general. Where does Dallas Turner go? He's kind of been the consensus top guy, but I'm kind of leaning right now that Latu is. I don't know where Turner fits in there.
Wow.
And that means Verse would be the third one in the pecking order, and I expect them to be there at 21 as things currently stand.
Wow, I wouldn't move. That would be – I would go. I didn't think he would be there, man. If he's there, I am going to go nuts. That's going to be absolutely phenomenal. All right, so let's get to the second round. What are the players that you see there? Because I actually see a couple defensive tackles that are there. Maybe you can also find an interior lineman there, a safety. So talk to me. What are the value players there at that spot for the Dolphins that you think are realistic?
So this is where I look at interior offensive line, and I feel like there's a couple players that would make some sense. Christian Haynes from UConn is probably the best outside zone run blocking guard in the draft. And there's some questions with pass protection and true pass sets. But again, if we look at the identity of what the offense is, and you talked about the right guys coaching the offensive line, and it's Butch Berry, and then it was Matt Applebaum, and then it was Lem Jean-Pierre, and then it was Steve Marshall in 2020, and Guglielmo in 2019, and Jeremiah Washburn in 18, and Chris Forrester is the first guy you go back to in 16 and 17 that's been here for more than 1 year as an offensive line coach. Butch Berry, their whole point of emphasis is everything looks the same until it's not. Urgency and explosiveness off the ball. And when you are a really good zone run blocker like that, it reduces the time under tension for you in pass protection, and they do a lot of boot action, and they do a lot of play action passing, where you get to execute it like the run game. And I think that gives you enough wiggle room for a guy like Haynes, where early in his career, until he gets NFL coaching and continues to get a little better, I think he'd be an immediate upgrade over who you have in the guard spots other than Isaiah Wynn right now, which how much can you really count on because of the injury history? So I think Haynes, I think Jackson Powers Johnson is somebody they could potentially sniff in the second round. I think he could be in the 40s, and that's one of those we'll be flexible. Do we want to be aggressive if we feel like we can get him? I think Cooper Beebe at guard. He played tackle at Kansas State.
Left tackle, right guard, right tackle, right guard, left tackle, left.
Everything other than center, right?
Other than center. That guy's played 4 out of 5. I like him, dude.
He's a big time phone booth guy. So he's got some good vertical displacement too, but he's got a little bit of tackle athleticism to him. So he's a real wide body type too. If you like guards that are built like refrigerators or your office desk, like he's got that look about him, and it makes you run a little extra around the loop when you're trying to turn the corner on him in pass pro too. So I think that's a sweet spot for guys like that. And I think because of what you saw in free agency, where you had a lot of teams that spent big time dollars on guards. And I think that's the one kind of storyline where the tackle free agent market was really bad. And now we're hearing we're going to get a really early run and a lot of urgency to draft tackles in a good top heavy tackle class. Teams spent big time money on guards in free agency. A lot of them, the Panthers, they gave Damian Lewis $13.5 million per, and they gave Robert Hunt $20 million per. And that's just an example. I mean, you had, the Detroit kids, Jonah Jackson got, I think, $15 million. Robert Hunt's old teammate, Dotson got $16 million for the Rams. Like, teams spent money on guards. I think that gives you a better chance of having some of the rookie interior players get a little further down in the draft order, where Miami would have one that would make a lot of sense for them to pick.
You know, it's interesting because when I watched the two players, they're a lot alike in the way they play their game. And yet the people coaching them kind of manage things a little bit differently. And what I mean by that is, and I know Teron was there for a while in New Orleans, obviously, but around Drew Brees, they were very center and guard centric. They always were focused on having very good center guard because shorter quarterbacks need the pocket to be really, really strong because they use passing lanes more than taller quarterbacks. Taller quarterbacks are able to see over the blocking sometimes, so they can see the whole play developing. Whereas what people don't realize, I always tell somebody, because a scout told me this 20 something years ago, he goes, I was at a bar with him, and he goes, all right, I want you to do this. I want you to get here in front of the table, and I want you to lean down and get under the table and put your hands under the table like you're a center. And I'm like, you want me to fucking do this in a bar? Are you out of your mind? And he goes, yeah, just do this for me. And so I did it. And he goes, so how are you seeing things now? And I go, well, a lot lower. And he goes, so imagine if you're a smaller quarterback and you're crouched down. And then when you stand up, bigger people are standing up in front of you. How can you see everything? Smaller quarter. And this is way before Tua came to the mix. And he goes, smaller quarterbacks are seeing a receiver. And then they're seeing him disappear. Then they're seeing him reappear. Then they're seeing him disappear. Do you know how hard that is to throw through those windows? It is very hard. So it's very important to have. Now, on this team, there seems to be a real more focus on the tackles, not nearly as much desperation as New Orleans. So as a guy that watches tape, and I'm sorry if I put you kind of in a weird spot, because this is kind of a question that came out of nowhere. What do you see in that? Because it's kind of odd, right? Because New Orleans would probably do whatever they can to kind of keep that middle solid, whereas Miami's kind of playing with it a little bit, playing with fire a little bit, even though they kind of know what they're doing and they got good coaching and good foundation and all of that. But it's not nearly, you know, you are taking some risks here, whereas on the tackle part, you're pretty solid. You know, overall, I can tell you got Keon and Kendall Lamb backing up these two guys, so you're pretty solid. So kind of the philosophy of New Orleans around Brees and then the philosophy around Tua.
I think the marriage there or the bridge there comes with marrying the Shanahan system as the running game that goes with that, where when you are a wide zone and outside zone heavy run action team, and then you build your passing game off of that, your guards, you got bumpers on both sides of you, right? You're going to have a tackle on one side of you, and you're going to have a center on the other side of you. And those guys are better athletes than you are. So you naturally have a little bit more baked in cushion. There's more bodies around you. You're not playing in space necessarily, where I think New Orleans being a little bit more inside and vertical run game, and then a little bit more of the straight drop back passing than what Miami is, where Miami moves the pocket for two a little bit more. Having the athleticism at tackle helps get that horizontal flow going for the entire front seven, because those linebackers see those tackles get out of there and they know that we got to get on it or they're going to get the edge on us. And if Mostert and Achane get the edge on us, we're going to be big time trouble. And right. that creates some of those throwing windows because of the pocket moving and the front moving to emulate run action and how they pass off of that, where I don't think that was necessarily one of the staples of New Orleans, where it was just that much more important to have an interior, an authentic interior wall. So yeah, we can drop back and go five-step passing game. And we know the pocket's going to be good. I think that's the biggest difference for those
inside guys. Running with New Orleans actually. Yeah, so that's because the focus is more outside running than inside running. So then that's where your strength was also at the same time. It's just that for a guy like Tua, I just think it's so important to have the center of that, you know, your guards and your centers to be so stout, because you've got to give, you know, shorter quarterbacks passing lanes, bro. It's just, you know, just incredibly important. All right, so
can I piggyback off that real quick?
Of course. Go.
I think an interesting subplot to that, too, is the actual personnel that Miami has. Connor Williams was a college tackle and was 6'5". Aaron Brewer's like 6'1". So you now your own players, your own bodies that are in front of your quarterback. You got 4-inch shorter player at center. The leverage is going to be better. But from a field vision perspective, you can't control how tall the defensive linemen are. But the offensive lineman, if he's blocking and engaged, is going to be closer to you anyway. So I just think that's an interesting little fold that I noticed. And I was thinking about Robert Hunt, who is, again, a college tackle, was 6'5". And I was really interested in them potentially bringing in Damian Lewis before I found out that the Panthers were going to pay him $13.5 million per. But he was 6'2", right? So it's like, oh, okay, like you can actually get your own guy shorter, more stout, bowling ball, compact frames. And that can kind of help with the field vision a little bit too. So I'll be interested to see if they do draft an interior offensive lineman, if it will be a guy who is a little bit more compact frame, because I think that is an area that you can maybe help to, as compared to all these college tackles that are now playing inside, but they're still 6'5". So they still have that vision element for your own players inside too.
And since you're shorter and lower to the ground, you're going to get more leverage under, which then you'll fold the defensive lineman, hopefully, because that's kind of the idea. Because when you get your pass block, you know, sometimes it's the fault of the lineman who didn't punch to keep that arm down, you know what I mean? And so that's kind of what they teach you. It's like, yeah, we're getting our passes, but well, okay, quarterback's got to watch that, but you got to help him out too by punching that guy and making sure you keep those arms down, because they don't keep their arms up when you're hitting them. They got to use their arms to protect themselves. So let's hit these guys, you know? So it's kind of it's funny how all the little nuances of the game, you don't really balance it all out to really understand. In order for one play to happen, there's a shit ton of stuff that has to be executed the right way by everybody in order for that thing to happen, you know? And all those little things, like, you know, I've told this story many times. I'm sitting there with an O-line scout, right? And this is a funny story. He goes to me, yeah, no, I got to work on this guy if we get him. Why? And he goes, why? And I go to him, why? And he goes, well, because he blinks on contact. And I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, I can't have a lineman to blink on contact. And he goes, why? You're going to miss the next spin. I need you to keep your eyes open on contact. Never knew that shit. I learned that shit, you know, 20 years ago, going to places, because that's where you get to meet the people that actually coach this shit up. You know what I'm saying? And so like they teach you all these little things, you know, and to make you a smarter football fan. But it's just funny, man. I was just talking about this earlier that, you know, all the weight of the world is put on the quarterback. Oh, well, Tua's got to do this. And it's like, if Tua was greasy in 73, where he passed 7 times in a Super Bowl to win it, we call greasy smart, accurate, great quarterback, all that. You know what we'd do to Tua nowadays? Oh, Tua sucks, bro. He only passed the ball 7 times. He got carried. If Tua was Woodstock, okay, in 82, that I watched that too, and, you know, they were mediocre quarterbacks that were carried by the defense in the running game, kind of like Peyton Manning in that second Super Bowl. Yep. You know, Tua would get killed. It's funny how the double standard exists there. And it's just like we put too much weight on the quarterback in a game that ultimately takes a team, dude. Mahomes 3 years ago didn't have an offensive line, and he was assassinated.
Yeah,
in the Super Bowl. You know, it's just funny like that, dude.
It's not the NBA or NHL where Bob can stand on his head and win you a game. Like it's very difficult to have one individual player. And I know that's really hard for grasping the game because of the dollar amounts that quarterbacks get paid and you touch the ball on every play. So like, I get it, but at the same time, football is a totally different beast because of all of the codependent variables. And it makes it very difficult, in my opinion, to have very binary black and white, yes and no, absolute opinions on a lot of things because it's the play calls and the execution and the route adjustment from the receiver based on the leverage of the specific coverage that you got and where you're supposed to bend that route off. And did the tackle set right? Or did the tackle set vertical when he was supposed to take a short set and get caught up in your lap? And now you got to throw the ball around them. So the ball play, like every play. And that's why I love football. And that's why I love really getting into the minutiae of the game, but it does make it extremely difficult to just have the absolutist. This is the case. 1000% definitive, it's this player or that player.
Yeah, it's too micro. We're too micro, and we're not really looking at the big picture, you know, unfortunately. All right, so who's the player you want for the Dolphins in the second round before I let you go?
Oh, man. I would go – I'll give you a couple names. I have my own draft board up here. If you were going to go with a guard, it would be Haynes from Connecticut would be my preferred choice there. If you were going to go with an interior defensive lineman, I really like Michael Hall Jr. from Ohio State, big time penetration guy, maybe not the best sack production or like raw production, but first step explosiveness is there. He's got a little bit more length than some of the other twitchy guys as far as interior guys where you can get your hands up and disrupt the pocket. Or I think he's really good with his hands to be able to implement pass rush counters, where then I think about like Fisk from Florida State, who a lot of people are excited about because of how well he tested, but he just doesn't have the length element of his game. And I think inside it's paramount to have it to a certain degree. And then if I were going to go with a receiver, if they didn't want to go commit whatever they're probably going to end up committing to Odell Beckham in free agency, because there was a player that's too good to be true at wide receiver on day two. I like Ricky Pearsall from Florida there. So those are three names at defensive tackle, into your offensive line, and wide receiver is kind of secondary needs for Miami or primary needs, depending on how you look at it, that I would like for them to go for.
All right, Kyle, tell them about Locked On Dolphins podcast, what they can do, brother, to hook up with you, sir.
Yeah. So we're on YouTube or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. It's 5 days a week. This time of year, we're doing probably 8 shows a week, but 5 days a week for sure. And we try to really get into a lot of the same things that you're talking about, Big O, as far as the why. I love exploring the why. And when decisions are made, you explore why the decisions are made. You talk about how it can go right, how it could go wrong. But I'm not somebody that's going to sit here and tell you definitively, this is how it's going to go, this is what it's going to be, because you don't know, right? We just got done talking about all of the variables that are in play. But I really try to understand the thought process of how this team is run, what they try to do on a week-to-week basis in season. And you can find it on YouTube or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Nobody better breaking it down, X's and O's, and telling you about the heart and soul of the game than my man Kyle Krabs there. So he does an excellent job. Follow him on Twitter at Grinding the Tape. He knows his shit. That's the bottom line. He knows his shit. Kyle, much love, my brother. Thank you for taking the time. We appreciate you as always. We'll catch you at camp at some time, my friend.
Sounds great, Big O. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. There you go. Kyle Krabs.